to Stories That Matter, Hawkwood's podcast series which invites changemakers, thinkers, artists and innovators to discuss the stories that have influenced them, their visions for the future and the actions they are taking to change the world. Today we are talking to two artistic collaborators who are just two of the 150 artists we welcome every year to Hawkwood to create new work. I'm sitting here with British composer Louis Mander, who trained at the Royal College of Music in London, as well as Birmingham University. His music is internationally performed and includes a prolific output of chamber opera, vocal music, chamber music, concerti, and music for film. He has collaborated with numerous writers and librettists, including the actor and writer Stephen Fry, with whom he created the chamber opera The Life to Come. He has most recently collaborated with the British poet Pam Ayres on a new musical based on J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. I'm also here with Tamsin Treverton-Jones, who is a published author and librettist. She previously pursued a freelance portfolio arts career as a theatre festival and museum publicist, magazine journalist, radio broadcaster and community oral historian. Her work lies in the creative space between textbook accounts of history and the remembered experience of those who lived through it. Her published works include a non-fiction nature memoir marking the 30th anniversary of the Great Storm of 1987. The Waves, which we are here to talk about today, is her second opera, but the first opera she was commissioned for was a new contemporary opera set on the canals of South Yorkshire, and it was commissioned and supported by Arts Council England and the Britain Peers Arts. Tamsin also works as a consultant and researcher on theatre and television projects. So, Louis and Tamsin, welcome back to Hawkwood. So, a couple of weeks ago, you spent some time here in residence with us with an entirely new cast to create your new opera, The Waves, based on Virginia Woolf's novel of the same name. So today I'd love to find out a little bit more about your personal and collaborative journeys before we hear about the work itself. So Louis, over to you. Welcome, welcome back. It's lovely to have you here today.
Lovely to be back.
Great, fantastic. Can you share the story of how you got started as a composer?
So from the age of 11 I was playing the piano, and I was playing the piano every hour I could. I became a pianophile. And this meant that I wanted to then make my own music whilst I was practising my Beethoven sonatas and Bach conventions. And at the time, the idea of translating the sounds onto the written page was something really new. So music publishing software was just really emerging. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you could then sit at the computer and translate what you'd composed on the piano then onto the computer to then have it printed was a remarkable exercise. And so that's how I really began writing music, through music software.
Wonderful. And can I just ask, when did you first actually write your first piece? How old were you?
I think I must have been 13, and my piano teacher, who's no longer with us, she studied at the Royal College of Music, as I did. Mm-hmm. And she was also a cellist. And so she studied at the same time as Julian Lloyd Webber.
Ah.
And so she used to go to their home for her cello lessons. So not only did she teach the piano, she also taught the cello. And I was entranced by the cello as an instrument. So for her, I wrote her a ballad in the key of G minor for cello and piano, and then we performed it at one of her student concerts. So I must credit her, who, I must say, also has spent some time at Hawkwood in her time, because she did live in Stroud.
Is that right? Ah, mm-hmm. Well, what interconnected webs we weave.
Incredibly so. And actually, at the preview, a gentleman came up to me who said, "You're Angèle's pupil, aren't you?" And so that was a lovely connection with her, what I feel was her message to me, even though she's no longer here.
How special.
And so I must credit her in inspiring me to write music.
Wonderful. And do you still have a copy of your first ever composition?
That's such a good question, because I don't.
Oh, I've what a shame.
It.
Lost to the mists of time, yeah. But there we go. There we go. Thank you so much, Louis. That's fascinating to hear. And we're here with Tamsin too. Hi.
Hello.
Tamsin.
Hi.
I'd love to hear your story. And now, because you've had a very varied career, and how did you land on becoming a librettist? It was pure chance, actually, because I can honestly say that opera hasn't been my first area of interest. It really has become an area of interest over the last 4 or 5 years. I landed on, I saw a job advertised, a composer needed somebody to write the words for a new opera, and I applied. I'd had a huge amount of experience in gathering testimonies from people, which I then converted into books about, you know, community history and oral history. And the project that she was working on was taking a story of somebody who had worked on the canals of South Yorkshire and turning it into an opera for one woman, a monodrama. Very complicated, very difficult. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I applied and I managed to get the job. And it was this most massive learning curve, going from writing prose and freeform journalism and poetry and taking all of that that I'd already had under my belt and then finding a way to shape that into a libretto. And I must admit, it was a very steep learning curve, and I had some help. I had a mentor along the way.
Who was that?
The most amazing woman, who I'm going to big up right now.
Fantastic.
A bit like your early influence, Louis. She's called Jennifer Farmer. She's a dramaturg and a librettist, and she works in London. But she was offered to me by Britton Peers, who we were going to Britton Peers in Suffolk to workshop this opera. And they offered me the chance of having a mentor. And I grabbed it. And she's been phenomenal, actually. And she's remained my mentor now over the last few years. So even though we're no longer working on that opera, I still consult with her.
That's wonderful. It's so important to have these figures in one's life to guide and support and give feedback.
That's right. Yeah. To give feedback, but also to defend you. It's a difficult world, the opera world. I mean, she was very much, you know, she was all about making sure that you're working within your zone rather than being asked to do stuff that was outside or being asked to do too much. She was very, very good at shaping me and moving me towards this final libretto. And when I started on The Waves, we did have a couple of sessions early on. So Louis and I have been working for nearly a couple of years on this. And she was really helpful at the beginning, helping me to get my ideas in order, because I'll be honest with you, I had a few false starts.
Oh, well, I think it always happens in the creative process, actually.
Definitely,
yeah,
definitely.
Wonderful.
So it's been... So I'm saying I'm a librettist now. This is my second libretto. And I'd like to carry on and do more, because I really feel that it speaks to my experience, my interest. It actually, the poetic, particularly the poetic, is what I love, because I've always written poetry and combined it with all my other work. And I think particularly working with Wolf, whose language is very, very poetic, it was an absolute joy to work with that language. So, yes, it's been great.
Great. What interesting journeys you've both had. Mm. But I'm interested now in how you actually met. How did that happen? Louis, would you share?
So it's quite a roundabout way of meeting, but we have a mutual friend. Well, we discovered we had a mutual friend who's called Mary, who's a yoga teacher. And Tamsin's a qualified yoga teacher. My husband, Vincenzo, is an avid yoga fan. And we had happened to go to a yoga class that Mary was teaching. And Mary said, "Oh, Louis, you write opera. Have you ever met my friend Tamsin? She's written a libretto." So that, in essence, is the serendipity of us meeting.
I absolutely love that story, to find that yoga has brought into the world a new opera.
It did, didn't it?
That's really wonderful.
In fact, she was going to claim something, didn't she write? So she wanted to have some claim on the opera.
She's an expert matchmaker.
Yes.
Fantastic. I love that. Well, in fact, I mean, it's all the things that we do here at Hawkwood when we're looking at well-being, we're looking at creativity, and it's future thinking. It's amazing how all these things interweave. But it's a lovely story about yoga. And so... You met, but how did you actually land on thinking about working with Virginia Woolf's The Waves?
That was you.
That was Louis.
Yes, I have to take the blame. I didn't know which of her novels was the one which I should sort of explore. And I just saw the waves, clicked. Unfortunately, I must say, I did use Wikipedia. I didn't read it first. But noticed that one of the characters in the novel has my name. And so for me, that was a sign. So then I said to Tamsin, let's have a look at the waves. And Tamsin did all the groundwork, I must say. She did all the groundwork. And she said to me afterwards, she said, look, I've read it and I think it can be turned into a good chamber opera. So
yeah, fantastic. That's literally how it happened, because although I'd read lots of Wolf, I hadn't read The Waves. And the reason I hadn't read The Waves is for the same reason that a lot of people haven't read The Waves. It's regarded as her masterpiece, but at the same time, it's regarded as an incredibly difficult novel to read, because it doesn't read like a novel. It's a series of dramatic monologues. Anyway, when Louis said this, I went away, and it took me rather a long time to get into it and to understand it. But the things that jumped out at me straight away was you had this amazing balance of voices. You had three men, you had three women, you had the potential to have, you know, the range, the full range, soprano, baritone, tenor, and contralto. And the other thing that I think was really, really special about it when I first picked it up and started reading it was that the characters were so defined. And for me, that, and in fact for us in the end, Louis, that was the way that we got into it, wasn't it? It wasn't through, I mean, there are a myriad themes. There is so much in that book, and she was trying to achieve so much. But the way that Louis and I entered it and tried to understand it and make sense of it was through character. We decided to write arias, and that was our first attempt, wasn't it? We decided to...
Yeah, I had a suggestion that if we carved out an aria for each character that would captivate their emotional journey throughout the piece, it would then give us a springboard, especially for me, because, yes, the words come first, but then carving out the music, it is a big process. Not to say that the words isn't a big process, but carving out the music thematically to integrate it, it's actually a lot more work than you would imagine. So having six arias that we could then drop in, almost like dropping them in at the specific places within the rest of the work, it gave us these landmarks that we could then feel satisfied with. Mm. And also it ensured that the audience had a really digestible form of each character, because often in an opera, you think, oh, well, that character could have had more development, or that character could have had more understanding. But this meant that we could so easily then put the rest of the flesh on the skeleton with all these arias.
Fantastic, because it's so interesting to hear behind the scenes on the creative process, because effectively you hadn't worked together before.
No.
You were approaching a very challenging text. Mm. And I like the way that you approached it through structure in order to give it some framing, because almost it may have been impenetrable as to where you start if you hadn't done that.
Mm.
And we work with another lovely artist here called Helen Chadwick, fantastic composer, singer. And when she came on a residency here at Hawkwood, she took over Studio 2 and she structured her entire composition around the room with what was going to happen when before she approached it. So it's interesting to hear similarities between the way that people work together. It is
very fascinating, actually, because it also helped then, once we had those six markers, we could... Because the story of the opera isn't the story of the book. People say, oh, it's not the book. It isn't the book, it's the opera. The Waves is the opera. It's been reimagined for the stage. And what I had to do was find a way to get all those messages across. But as Louis said, we had those wonderful markers that we dropped in at each point. But to create a structure around that was the next challenge.
Yes.
And of course, what we did in the end was we turned it into the first half anyway, is a sort of dream world. So the character Bernard is living in his head. He's having thoughts about his friends in the past. So he's in the present, they're in the past. And only at the final scene when they come together do they all end up being in the same room. That was challenging to stage, but it was a very... it felt quite intuitive to make it that way. I think it works.
Fantastic. Well, it certainly worked when we heard it a couple of weeks ago now here at Hawkwood. Yeah. And it was absolutely fascinating how you managed to create a world premiere within 3 days of arriving at Hawkwood with an incredible cast. Would you like to share how you put the creative team together?
I had worked with Einar Borger in 2017 when he directed the opera I wrote with Stephen Fry at the studio at the Oslo Opera House. Mm-hmm. After that production, we became friends, and I'd always wanted to work with him, with me as conductor. When the opera The Life to Come was performed, I wasn't conducting it. So I had always wanted to work with him in the room, because the relationship between the stage director and the musical director is quite a fine balance. And we're both, in many ways, generous in the room that we allow people to have their own creative input. It's not always the case, but in such a short space of time, it really was the only way, because there can be no ego, because the ego would then take over the piece. So that was the reason I chose Einar to direct The Waves. And we'd been there together with him from the very start. We met together in November of last year and had a wonderful meeting. Tamsin, you were there as well. And I think it was important that he could be there from the start before we'd even written much more than six arias.
Absolutely amazing. And I know it's a huge journey, because you're both effectively acting as producers as well as the creative team. And in order to arrive at Hawkwood, there was an enormous amount of work that went on behind the scenes that anyone who came to that sharing of work would have had no idea about. And Tamsin, maybe you'd like to share a little bit about that journey, what it takes to put on a creative work.
Oh, goodness, yes, it's huge. Mm. I think the thing to remember about what we did here at Hawkwood was that it was... ultimately, we did apply for various funding pots and so on, but in the end, we managed to crowdfund in a very short space of time, which made enough money due to thanks to the generosity of lots of local people, friends and supporters and so on, to enable us to come here for those 4 days, and to fly the Norwegians over and to make sure that everybody got their travel paid. So it was a small amount of money, but it was enough. It was that springboard that we needed. But yes, you're right. It was an enormously, not difficult, time-consuming, and occasionally challenging. And we went through a few ups and downs along the way. But we got there.
I know. And that sense of achievement was palpable, actually. It was... everyone was committed to the project like I haven't seen. And sometimes to get these creative works out there in the world, the struggle behind the scenes, although the audience don't appreciate it, actually brings the team together. And I really felt a sense of team spirit.
I would here. Just say that actually that is in large part due to Louis's incredible generosity to the singers. There was never... It was really interesting to watch how he conducts and encourages. There's no criticism. There was a lot of allowing, and I think Einar as well, to a certain extent, it generated a real camaraderie in the room. Over a very, very short period of time, those singers became friends. A couple of them did know each other, but there was more than that, wasn't there, Lou? There was a kind of a sense of togetherness that was generated.
I also think that Wolf's narrative gave them a real understanding of their work together, because the Bloomsbury set were very much intertwined, and I think they're so gifted, those singers, to be able to jump in like into a pool of Wolf, that they absorbed it all. And I mean, they're just very talented young professional singers, and they're actors as well. We forget that opera singing isn't simply the voice, and goodness me, they have good voices, astonishing voices, but also they're natural stage animals. But I was just so... I felt so grateful that they enjoyed what I'd written to the degree that they wanted to show me how beautiful it was, because you are at the mercy of your performer. And so they took to it with such an open heart that it often brought tears to our eyes in rehearsal. And so the generosity of their artistry created a beautiful environment, but in large part also to this hermetic experience at Hawkwood, which through the nutrition and through the ethos gave them all a comfortability that ordinarily they would not have been able to share with such depth.
Yeah, and in a cold rehearsal room on a London high street, it wouldn't have been quite the same.
No, well, I think that's what we hope that Hawkwood can bring to the creative process,
sure,
is the holding of the space and the support for the artist, for them to do the work that they need to do. And it's the bits around the edges, like the food and the just checking in occasionally from the team, that I hope does help.
Absolutely.
The creative process.
Well, actually, can I just say also that I completed the libretto here. I was given that space to complete it here, and I don't know that I would have been able to do that had I not had that incredible generosity of Hawkwood either, so thank you for that.
Yes, that's right, you were in the garden room, next door to this room. We're in the library at the moment.
Yes,
but it was actually lovely to have a librettist in residence.
Thank you, I loved it too.
fantastic. So it was a huge success, and we put together something that had 70 people that came, and we couldn't have fitted another person in that room. And I'm really interested to hear, before we move on to your wider influences, actually, what's next for the Waves?
Well, we already, because thanks to Einar and the Norwegian connection, we have been invited to stage the Waves in Oslo in September. And in fact, we've been given a beautiful space. I think it's the Old Town Hall.
That's
or something.
Correct. Yes.
In the middle of Oslo. And we are the final performance on the final night of the opera in the hall. We'll be doing another Q&A, I think. Possibly two performances, is it? Or
yes,
at least
I think
one?
There'll be two performances.
Yeah. So, again, I think Louis knows the producer of the Oslo Opera Festival, Yuril Songvoll, who has been quite interested from the start. And
she's been a great advocate for my music, and she was the guiding light of commissioning The Life to Come. She's very much an opera mama, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So she is the person that allows these fledging opera singers to really fledge. And so she has a very positive impact. But also she supports new work. We're very lucky to have the voice of Dame Sian Phillips. I contacted the patron of the Virginia Woolf Society, Eileen Atkins, Dame Eileen Atkins, to ask if she would voice Woolf, but she was unable to do so. But she did recommend I contact Sian Phillips, who is very excited to be reading the prose passages, which we will pre-record. And
great.
Then she will be in the premiere, the Norwegian premiere in September.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's so exciting. We'll watch this space on the Waves. I think there's going to be great things ahead. So, Louis, I'm just interested in hearing a little bit more about you as a composer. And I wondered, what are some of the most significant challenges you faced in your career? And you know, what lessons have you learned from them? Or how have you integrated some of those challenges?
I have faced quite a few challenges, and these were largely in the education process, standing up for my own style, because studying at the Royal College of Music, one was expected to adhere to certain stylistic fundamentals, which for me were odds with what I felt was my aesthetic. I'm a tonalist, I'm a lyricist, in as much as I don't write lyrics, but I write lyrical music. And so it's not to say that one couldn't be a tonalist or a contemporary tonalist, but it reflected in the appreciation of my work. It was regarded as maybe old-fashioned.
Ah, I see.
And though now we're in a different stage where the rise of an enjoyment of film music has really encouraged people to write in contemporary ways that are tonal and are lyrical, but also dramatic, because I have this fundamental belief, and it's quite a bold one, I'm going to tell you now, is that fully atonal music can only really describe one emotion, and that is ennui.
Ah.
Or distress.
Right.
And so I have to live by that. So therefore I can write atonally, and the Music of the Waves does have some atonal parts, but it is a palette which also includes unbridled lyricism, diatonicism, writing in one key without chromaticism, but also chromaticism. So the challenge for me was being able to stand firm to my belief of how I wanted to write the music I wanted to listen to. Because as a composer, I'm only writing music, really, that I want to listen to. And if anyone else enjoys it, that's just a bonus.
Wonderful. But I also think that your approach to that compositional aesthetic is so important to be coupled with a text like The Waves, which is incredibly complicated. And therefore you need that, in a way, accessibility and allowance of the music to allow you to access some of the main themes and stories coming through.
I mean, I was talking to Tamsin, and we were talking just before we began recording this podcast, and you know, we have some ideas for our next opera, but I said I just can't set the word Instagram, I can't set the word mobile phone, smartphone, I just can't set these words to music. So this is why I've always gone for, so I mean, E.M. Forster's The Life to Come, that exotic gay novella which Stephen Fry adapted for a two-act opera, a full-length opera. I know where my limits are. And so it was lucky to work with Tamsin, who has an appreciation of the same aesthetic, poetry-driven. Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Tamsin, you've had such a varied career, as we heard earlier. I'm just really interested in who's been a major influence or inspiration in your life.
I've had a lot of people who've supported me along the way. I think I'm talking about palettes, interestingly enough. I feel like I've worked in a lot in theatre. I did actually do a stint at the Opera House when I was younger, but always in this sort of rather supporting role, not the creative role. So I was doing a lot of publicity and PR and press, and I enjoyed that, and I met some great people, but I was always inspired by the directors and by the writers. They were the ones that I looked to and enjoyed working with. I loved working with the actors as well, but it was always the writers. And they're almost too numerous to mention. I mean, most recently, in terms of opera, I mean, I've found that I really looked to someone like Martin Crimp, whose work with George Benjamin is really fascinating. And what I realise about him is the way, in fact, Louis picked me up on this. This is a libretto that I've written. Martin Crimp doesn't call what he writes for opera libretto, he calls it text for music. Mm. And there's something about the way he pairs his language down that really appeals to me.
Mm-hmm.
The distillation of language, the bringing of words down to one sentence that can express huge emotion. And that is where I think I'm happiest. And it's challenging. It takes me a long time. I'm not like Louis. I can't just turn around and, you know, he's got incredible speed and fluidity of thought. I'm much more sort of dedicated to pulling out what needs to be said and by sort of compressing it, really, distilling it. Like, at the moment, Martin Crimp, he's written four operas with George Benjamin, and his libretti for me are, you know, they're a source of inspiration.
Fantastic.
Very much more pared down. But poetry has always been my thing. And similarly to Louis, I've had to kind of stick out for the way I write, stand up for the way I write. So when I first wrote my book, The Great Storm of 1987, that began as a poetry collection. I wanted to write 30 poems, one for every year since the storm. I had a personal connection to the storm, which I won't describe here because that's a completely different story. But I wanted to write these poems. And interestingly enough, my poetry was picked up by a literary agent who wanted to turn it into a book.
Mm.
And I said, great, I can write the stories of the poems, but can I keep the poetry? And in the end, I wasn't allowed to keep the poetry in the book because the publication of the stories was what mattered. They didn't want the poems as well. And that was upsetting for me. Although yes, the book was great and was a success and everything, I sort of have been so delighted to be able to return to something so lyrical and so beautiful as Wolf's language in this, because I think that is where my heart is. It's in the poetry.
Well, maybe we need to find a way to make sure those poems get published. Oh, hearing that.
Well, they're all sitting there waiting to be reworked. And in fact, I do have a further life for them in my mind. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And, Louis, I was just... This is one of those podcast questions that you get asked. So if you're sitting here now thinking back on your career, what would you say to your younger self?
That's a really good question, isn't it?
You don't have to answer it, actually, if you don't want to.
I would have just congratulated... This sounds quite an arrogant answer, but I think I would have just congratulated myself for taking huge risks. Taking huge risks, because it is a risk to present... I've always worked within a theatrical format, either opera or music for theatre, because I was enabled to write for people, and I love people and their characters. So I always took risks with the subject matter, because the reason I wrote to Stephen Fry when I just came out of college was because I felt going to the opera house, there was nothing representative of, for me, same-sex relationships on stage. So at the time I said, Stephen, we need to present something which shows male relationship as an openly gay man. And that then led me to search and find other subject matters. I wrote an opera about Nijinsky and Diaghilev. I also wrote an opera which was based on an original short story, but had an element of identity, gender identity. And so this was important when I was young, to push forward to represent more of an equality within our relationship identity.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's so interesting to hear. And do you find, therefore, I mean, that is actually very brave to take those risks as a young person. And do you find it's harder to take risks these days, or do you still feel that's part of your DNA?
The Wolf opera that we've just written was probably... I think it's the most mature thing I've written, and I didn't take as many risks. But that's just reflective of me in my 40th year. But when I was 23 writing an opera about Diaghilev and Nijinsky, and we had an opera essentially that was quite gratuitous in its sexuality, in Hackney, in a Steiner building. And it was quite incredible that I took those risks, because I don't know if I would do it so much now, because we live in a modulated world. And so I had that opportunity, say, 17 years ago.
Mm.
But I'm maturing in my style now, I think.
That's fascinating to hear your story. And I'm tempted to ask Tamsin the same question. Where you're sitting now and looking back, what would you say to yourself?
I just wish that I'd embarked on the writing career for earlier and had the courage, the confidence to be, you know, if it meant working in a bar or working as a lifeguard or something to supplement the time that I could write. And I didn't do that. I took a job, I took work in a related environment, which has been incredibly influential, working for the Royal Shakespeare Company for 5 years, working for the Royal Court Theatre, working at the Opera House, working for festivals, Bath Music. I've learned huge amounts. I've observed a lot, but there was always that thing that I wanted to do it myself. And I think that is what I would say to anyone. I mean, just have the courage to jump in and do it. And be true to what you really want to do. I think that's what I would have liked to have done earlier. Fantastic. But I'm doing it now. And yes. I've been doing it for the last 10 years. I've been writing full time. And the most joyous moment of my life is when I gave up the work that I was doing and I decided to sit down and write this poetry collection. And I got to this point where I said, I'm not going to do the work anymore. I am going to sit at home and I'm going to write these poems. And some days I would just sit and I would come out at the other end of the day with one line. And that would be such a huge achievement for me. And I would be so proud of that one line. And you know, allowing the words to just fill your head night and day.
Fantastic.
I think that's a real... It's a luxury, in a sense, but you can find ways of doing it. And I think that's what I'd say to my younger self.
Wonderful.
Get on and do it a bit earlier.
Well, at least you're giving yourself the space to pour forth all your creativity now, which is fantastic.
And everything I've learned along the way.
Yes.
I've learned, you know, the people I've worked with, the stuff I've seen, the places I've been, the people I've watched work have all been...
Everything keys
everything.
Into it,
it's
doesn't
like
it?
A big,
yeah.
Big casserole.
Wonderful.
Yes.
A creative casserole.
Yes.
Lovely. And I suppose, just coming to some final questions now, but is the one project that you would have been dreaming about that you would like to be commissioned for? Whether that's together or individually or both?
I think Louis and I would probably like to write another opera together. We are, obviously, we've been very immersed in Wolf and the Waves. But I think we both have ideas that need to be aired between us, don't we? Am I speaking out of turn?
No, not at all. I mean, when we were speaking, well, you kindly picked me up from the train station, and I said to you, I don't think I can write an opera as effectively or as beautiful as The Waves again. So
it really, really was, yeah.
And that's not... because for me, I was talking to one of the singers who played Susan, and it was just before... Because when you rehearse the opera, you essentially have like a jigsaw puzzle. And then at the end, as the person who's put the jigsaw puzzle together, you stand back and you look at the picture. Mm. And I said to May Haydorn, I said... Now we will know if it works, because we were going to run it from top to tail. And I was extremely nervous, because when you, for another analogy, would be a new recipe you're trying, you don't know until it's come out of the oven and you've dished it up and you've eaten it, if it works. And after we'd done it, she said, there you go, it works, doesn't it?
Wonderful. Well, I'm getting quite hungry, all these talks of casseroles and recipes. and maybe there's another project you've had in mind, Louis.
I would quite... We were talking about another adaptation. Oscar Wilde's only novel, A Picture of Dorian Gray, recently. The unabridged version has been published, and I know, Tamsin, you've had...
I've had a preliminary look at it. Yes.
How exciting.
Only inspired by, really, our talented singers, and I would love to keep our group together as Talent Opera, because it has the flexibility of all the voice types and such a willingness to learn new work that to use them in another format would be lovely.
Fantastic. And that's Talent Opera.
Talent Opera, yeah. Yes.
Talent House is where Virginia Woolf used to go as a child until her mother died when she was 12. And it's at... Talent House is the inspiration. The views from Talent House are the inspiration for three of her books, To the Lighthouse, Jacob's Room and The Waves. So we thought that... we should call her St. Ives Trio. So we thought Talent Opera was a good title for her. What we've done, but doesn't mean to say we have to do any more Wolf, but it's just a nice...
It's lovely, yeah, it really suits it. Well, I'd like to say a huge thank you to you both. And Louis, where can we find out more about your work?
So on Spotify, I have a few albums of music, mostly orchestral music.
Great.
But also on YouTube.
Well, we'll take a look there. And Tamsin?
My books are all on Amazon.
Amazon, here we come. Lovely. All right, thank you both for the podcast today. Really appreciated your contributions to the Hawkwood programme, and wish you all the very best for The Waves.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends, sign up to our mailing list, or on social media.